Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, to our discussion on literary festivals with Michael Sexton and Alice Grundy. I should mention first up that the Institute did invite Chip Rowley and the previous Artistic Director for the Sydney Writers' Festival and Gemma Birrell, the current Director for the Sydney Writers' Festival, to participate tonight, but they were not available. So we have two rather than three, but Michael Sexton, author who's spoken here before on a number of occasions, former member of the board of the Sydney Writers' Festival and New South Wales Solicitor General, is one of our speakers tonight, making a welcome return. And Alice Grundy, who's worked at the Sydney Institute but never spoken here before, speaks for the first time. She is the managing editor of Gerimondo Publishing and editor of the magazine Seizure. And the topic for tonight, we'll lead off with Alice and then follow up with Michael for about 15 minutes each, and we'll go to questions and discussion. The topic is literary festivals, classroom, sandpit or amusement park. Alice and Michael, you're most welcome. Let's start with Alice. Thanks.
Thank you, Jared and Anne, for having me. It's very exciting to be on this side of the podium as opposed to stacking chairs as I did when I was at uni. So 2013 is proving to be a boom time for literary festivals. By my count, there are over 20 significant festivals focusing on books and writing that take place from January to December this year. In the last 12 months, I've participated in or attended the Emerging Writers Festival, Melbourne Writers Festival, National Young Writers Festival, Sydney, etc., etc. I've corresponded with the organisers of Adelaide, Perth, Brisbane, as well as numerous smaller festivals such as Bendigo and Mildura. The Walkley Foundation, in partnership with the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, will be running the Storyology Festival at the beginning of August, and I'll be running two workshops there. So it's a buzzing industry. As editor of the literary journal Seizure, a biannual magazine, and also a website which publishes flash fiction and produces podcasts, I chaired a panel at the Sydney Writers' Festival this year. My day job, as Jared mentioned, is managing editor of Gerimondo, and I also attended sessions in the role of publicist. As an avid reader, I went to around 10 sessions to hear writers and critics speak about their work. These festivals breathe life into small towns in off-peak tourist periods, make Walsh Bay hum with punters, and furnish the ABC with a year's worth of author interviews. But the questions I ask myself as I wander the docks, sit on discussion panels, and attend talks is, what does the proliferation of writers' festivals mean for Australia's intellectual landscape, and is this a bubble which is pretty near close to bursting? In a post-GFC world, charitable organisations and private donors have less money to donate, and publishers are dealing with shrinking margins, so they're not as happy to contribute as they once were. Couple that with the fact that the Australia Council has the same money or less to spread around a greater number of festivals, and it seems that funding is under strain from just about every angle. And then I ask, who are all these festivals for? Audiences pay for tickets, speakers appear on panels and run workshops, publishers try to get their authors in sessions, and a veritable phalanx of volunteers staff each one. I can't help but wonder what each of these stakeholders is expecting to get from these festivals and whether they're satisfied. There is definitely a lovely chummy feeling at writers' festivals, the sense that some individuals are surrounded by like-minded people who also value the smell of books and long conversations about the relative merits of the free and direct style, as exhibited in Flaubert and Austen. But this sense of operating in an echo chamber is somewhat suffocating, and I'll return to that a little bit later. It's a place where people tend to agree on politics and the environment, and it's one of the inherent tensions in the literary festival schema, that the general homogeneity of the audience and the sense of preaching to the choir is perhaps one of literary festivals' greatest strengths and biggest shortcomings. The first stakeholder position I'd like to consider is that of the publisher. As is so often said, it's a tough time in publishing, not just in Australia, but around the world. In Australia, sales aren't just down on 2 years ago, they're down on 6 and 7 years ago, while the costs associated with book production, such as wages, freight, they have all generally increased. And despite Australia's generally tech-savvy population, we're still nowhere near the setup in the UK, where major publishers such as Hachette reported that in the last financial year, 25% of their sales came from e-books. It's impossible to talk about the current state of publishing and its challenge without mentioning piracy. If a book is being published by a trade publisher, it's almost guaranteed that a pirated version will exist. Piracy sites do respond to requests to remove the content, but you can be sure that if the file was on one site, there's plenty more with the same content available for free. Time and resource consuming. There's no real way to combat piracy other than to make purchasing easy and seem as though it's good value. Many people who pirate would not consider themselves thieves and wouldn't mind paying a fair price for a product. The difficulty is pricing products competitively and still managing to make a profit. Book publishers on the whole have not fully resolved the question of pricing in the digital space, and they're still trying to develop strategies to manage the balance between their presence online and, as the kids say, in IRL, in real life. Sorry, there's a pleonasm there. In an attempt to manage this quandary and deal with the big publishing bogeyman, Amazon, the big companies are getting bigger. In recent weeks, the Random House Penguin merger has been approved globally. Two of the English-speaking world's largest publishing houses are becoming one. And in what is perhaps a sign of increasingly business-minded behaviour to come and a divergence from the gentlemanly cottage industry style practices of publishing houses, Penguin Random House has invoked a clause in writer Vikram Seth's contract and requested the repayment of a $1.7 million advance since he failed to submit his manuscript for the sequel to A Suitable Boy on time. It is very rare for publishers to recall advances from authors, even in the case of a breach of contract. Similarly, publishers tend to pay legal bills relating to a book, despite the standard clause in contracts which states that authors are liable for all the content contained therein. Although bookstalls at Writers' Festival seemed crammed with punters and appear to be doing a roaring trade, books usually only clock up a couple of hundred copies sales, so in terms of revenue, it's not really enough to cover the cost of staffing a writer with a publicist and the accommodation and entertaining costs associated with making a visiting author happy. In part, this is because punters may have already bought the book, but could also be that after a session, they won't be so inclined to follow up with a purchase. Andre Dow, the 2013 editor of The Emerging Writer, a collection of essays released each year that accompanies the Emerging Writers Festival, has said that literary festivals are an important avenue for book sales, but this is really only the case for niche, small-scale publishers. For the trade publishers, festivals tend to be more of a PR exercise than a major sales event. Writers' festivals are an opportunity to increase a writer's profile, to please them by putting them in front of a room filled with avid and eager listeners, and to get some interest from the mainstream media. But there's an inherent tension in the publisher's desire to gain exposure with a view to turning it into sales and a program director's vision of showcasing the best content possible. Turning now to the question of what an audience attendee can expect from a festival, I wanted to talk about one of the big names for literary types at this year's Sydney Writers' Festival. One of the key international guests was James Wood, literary critic for The New Yorker, author of several books of criticism and one novel, and one of the most respected literary critics at work today. He appeared in three sessions, two of which were panel discussions, and one of which was an in-conversation with Sydney Morning Herald literary editor Susan Windham. Wood was engaging, self-effacing, and articulate in the two events I attended, even indulging Windham's request for a finger-drumming performance, as Wood had previously made a YouTube video of his tabletop percussive pursuits. Although the audience seemed absorbed with this performance, it did make me question why it is that people attend these sessions. Tickets to these events cost roughly the same amount as a movie ticket and last around one-third of the time. What is it that audiences respect in return for their money? One academic I know posted a prolonged commentary on their Facebook page lamenting the fact that panels and in-conversations are exclusively operating at one level of depth, or shallowness, as the case may be. That although someone like James Wood is a professor of the practice of literary criticism at Harvard, he, for whatever reason, was speaking in generalities, lightly and conversationally, in each event, rather than entering into details, specifics, and the nitty-gritty of his work. I cite his position at Harvard to add ballast to the point that aside from his work as a critic, he is clearly well-placed to talk about the nature of criticism, the ways in which it operates, and to consider in a detailed way what effect criticism has on the literary playing field. Perhaps if festivals are going to the trouble of bringing out high-profile intellectuals, they could include at least one session that matches their capacity. I wonder if literary festivals would benefit from having different streams for different audiences. For the most part, sessions would remain on a general, some might say, populist level, but in the same way that there are sessions dedicated to school children, perhaps there could be sessions dedicated to specialists in a given field, whether it be philosophy, science, journalism, or indeed politics. At the Melbourne Writers' Festival, which is coming up in August, if you haven't seen the program yet, you can go along to see Boris Johnson. He's giving the opening address, and for the stately price of $98, you can hear him in conversation with Annabelle Crabb before joining them for post-event canapés. I would hope that they're quite tasty for that. Ultimately, the conclusion that I can draw from this is that the role of literary festivals tends toward the popular and the accessible in order to reach the broadest market, to successfully increase the ticket sales and attendees each year, and to be able to triumphantly proclaim that numbers are up. But to turn the focus back on the audience, I'd like to consider one of the headline events of the most recent Sydney Festival that was entitled "Is Rhetoric Dead in the Age of the Soundbite?" On the panel were James Button, former speechwriter for Kevin Rudd, the Honourable Malcolm Turnbull, journalist Annabelle Crabb, Neil James from the Plain English Foundation, and it was chaired by Michael Fullerlove, Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. At lunchtime on a Sunday, the Sydney Theatre was packed full, another sold-out session. The demographic was primarily over 50, mostly white, and at $20 per ticket, they had something in the way of disposable income. With a panel of four speakers, there will always be a limit to the kind of nuance and dialogue that one can expect. But what really surprised me was that when Malcolm Turnbull started speaking about refugees, members of the audience began to boo and hiss. Unperturbed, Turnbull continued with his point, but the crowd eventually became so loud that Annabelle Crabb turned to the audience and asked them to be quiet so he could finish his point. Jared Henderson has made the point on multiple occasions that the Sydney Writers' Festival is partially taxpayer-funded, and that commentators and writers on the conservative side of politics tend to be underrepresented, to say the least. But if even Malcolm Turnbull can be booed, then it's not hard to imagine what sort of response a larger L liberal might elicit. What disappointed me about that session was the audience's inability to listen to an alternative viewpoint. In the echo chamber of their social circles, is it the case that they do not hear those views expressed and the airing of them is so repellent that they feel compelled to shout over the top of the speaker? I had hoped that the session "Is Rhetoric Dead in the Age of the Soundbite?" would lead to a relatively sophisticated discussion on the state of the media and the role in which politicians and the media both exploit gotcha moments and are trapped in a spiral of platitudes and weasel words in attempt to avoid faux pas. What eventuated was a series of brief comments, some of which were interrupted by the audience, limiting the potential for serious debate. Whether or not they agreed with Turnbull's comments was irrelevant. Rather, the fact that an invited guest was booed and hissed for expressing a view indicates some rather small-mindedness among the audience, in my opinion. On the topic of audience, but shifting to a somewhat different demographic, I'd like to turn now to the Emerging Writers Festival. Whereas the festivals in major cities come from a position of collecting writers so that readers can enjoy them, the EWF has been created to cater to a market of the growing number of people who want to be writers themselves. The Emerging Writers Festival celebrated its 10th anniversary this year. As their website states, they exist to promote the interests of emerging writers, to improve their opportunities for professional development as well as their engagement with the broader public. Earlier this year, I attended a City of Sydney Council consultation session about their cultural policy. Rachel Healy, Executive Manager of Culture, spoke briefly at the beginning to outline some of their intended outcomes. She said that passive audiences, or audiences who consume culture, have mostly remained static over the past decade, but active audiences, or audiences who create content, have undergone double-digit growth in the same period. The Emerging Writers Festival seems to respond well to that growing market, offering sessions for writers discussing how to improve their digital profiles, how to stay healthy and keep up an exercise regime, and meditation and creativity. In a world where publishing your work online is relatively easy and inexpensive, the other question is whether or not self-publishing is respectable, and that was definitely a hot topic. The fact that many writers are more interested in their own work than in reading work by others was highlighted for me in the final weekend when I was briefly staffing the literary magazine's bookstall. A young man struck up a conversation with me about Seizure. I described our ambit and the ideas which underpin the publication. He looked through it slowly before jotting down the website and saying, "Yes, I think I'll send you something." And he then replaced the magazine on the shelf. The current editor of Meanjin, one of Australia's oldest literary journals, Zora Sanders, has been quoted as saying that if everyone who submitted to MeAngin had a subscription, they would never need funding again. While the EWF schedules workshop sessions covering topics such as creative nonfiction and poetry, the primary focus of the festival does not appear to be educating writers about how to develop their own writing. I appeared on a panel entitled The Pitch, something of a misnomer as no pitches were made and it was not a session on how to pitch. The purpose of the panel was to discuss the publishing process for each of the publishers who had sent a representative. When it came to question time, the audience was craving specifics. The panel was asked, what is a reasonable advance? The answer, of course, is how long is a piece of string? Do I really have to have a Twitter account? And do I need to finish my book before I send it in? Having paid for entry, it felt as though the audience was keen to get a golden ticket, to hear a secret, or to find out about a shortcut for how their work could be published. After the panel, publishers were surrounded by eager writers keen to get their manuscripts seen out of the mires of the slush pile. Part of the continued success of this festival is this newish version of the writer. The romantic notion of a person alone in a garret with their pens and their most intelligent thoughts for company is being mistaken for a job. And they seem gravely disappointed when they find out how much work it takes to get noticed, or that there is such a thing as good writing and bad. It comes as an even greater disappointment when they find out that it isn't just about writing. It is about meeting people, connecting with others, and finding some sort of audience appeal before you can even begin to think about earning some money. EWF is clearly servicing a market, and it's giving them information. But that said, in a world where publishing is ever more competitive and certainly a flooded market, there is only so much assistance that such a festival can provide. After considering the publishers and the writers, then what of the presenters? A relative newcomer on the scene of literary festivals is Storyology, which will be taking place in August this year. Over 4 days, this festival, created and run by the Walkley Foundation and the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, will feature sessions from international guests such as the editor of BuzzFeed. I don't know how many of you will be familiar with that, but it's a very fluffy website. It's necessary to these festivals' existence to garner funding from the government, often at multiple levels, and from corporate sponsors. Part of Storyology's model is a request that speakers donate their time for free, as well as sourcing corporate support and funding from the copyright agency. In charging admission as well, their stated aim is to break even. Even with festivals that pay for participation, the amount of time consumed in preparation for an event might mean that a presenter will come out with an effective deficit for their efforts. There is a non-economic element to the transaction to do with the connection to audience exposure and the chance to plug your latest work, which outweighs the other concerns. One reason that writers and speakers will support these festivals and give their time is perhaps because it is rapidly becoming one of the few ways to connect with an audience, no matter who they are. One of the ironies of the internet and the freedom it has brought with it is that while people can now write whatever they want and publish whatever they want, we are trapped in the new bonds of obscurity. One of the buzzwords in publishing now is discoverability. It's one thing to write an earth-shattering novel and sell it through Amazon, but getting to a point where your intended audience can discover your work is a different and crucial next step. Also, at a time when review pages are shrinking and the amount of space dedicated to book criticism is diminishing, literary festivals furnish writers with an opportunity to engage with some more detailed responses to their work. It seems that people have taken the maxim everyone has a book in them seriously, and the number of wannabe writers has exploded. The mushroom cloud can be seen from space. This is good news for literary festivals, since they attract many people who would like to become writers. And the proliferation of festivals seems to be servicing this cohort of people, eager to hear about, discuss and consider the role of writing books and ideas, and their ability to draw large crowds and get them to part with their money. What remains to be seen is how long new festivals will continue to sprout up and whether the major festivals can maintain their pattern of year-on-year growth. And as cultural policies change and the pot of money available to writers' festivals needs to spread across more incarnations of the same kind of events, and the population interested in these sorts of festivals aren't growing at the same pace as the festivals themselves. It's platitudinous to say that there is no way for literary festivals to perfectly satisfy each of the stakeholders involved, since the interests of publishers, writers, audiences, and festival organisers can never neatly align. That said, Australia has one of the higher per capita book buying rates in the Western world. We have an industry of independent booksellers which is the envy of the US and the UK, and for the time being, literary festivals continue to draw record crowds, despite their ever-growing abundance. Thank you.
to Michael Sexton, folks.
Thanks, Jared. I feel as if I should be dressed in a more bohemian fashion to be talking about literary festivals, but I've come straight from the office, so there was no solution to that, I'm afraid. I've called tonight's talk The Rise and Rise of the Literary Festival. I suppose the first question to ask is, why have literary festivals at all? Reading is in many ways like writing, an essentially solitary activity. It's not, of course, as hard work as writing, but there's no doubt that there are many readers who don't feel the need to share their delight in books with anybody else. But over the last few decades, it's become obvious that there are many readers who see a social aspect to the world of books. This has been reflected in the rise of the book club and in the growth of literary festivals that have become established in most of the states and territories in this country. Some have also become big events in England, although they don't seem to be as common in Europe and in the United States. Alice would probably know more about whether that's true or not. So that perhaps reflects an element of Australian culture that remains, to some extent, a product of our original English origins. Even in England, however, the idea of the literary festival is a relatively recent one in historical terms. The oldest is the Cheltenham Literary Festival, which started in 1949. The other well-known festival, the Hay Festival of Literature and Arts, was established in 1988. It's interesting that for many centuries, neither readers nor writers saw the need for this kind of event. The Sydney Writers' Festival started in the 1990s. Its exact origins are a matter of some dispute that I won't go into tonight. Although Adelaide had an arts festival which incorporates a writer's week at a much earlier time, starting in 1960. The Adelaide Festival resulted in some celebrated literary romances over the years, some of which lasted and some of which didn't. One that did was the novelist Rose Tremaine and the literary biographer Richard Holmes, who were still together. Two that didn't were the poet Ted Hughes and the festival's media person, Jill Barber, and Robin Davidson's self-described volcanic three-year relationship with Salman Rushdie. Needless to say, most writers seem to enjoy talking about their books with other writers and with members of the audience at festival sessions. It always seemed doubtful to me that festivals produced a great deal in the way of book sales for most writers, and I think Alice has probably suggested that tonight. Some overseas writers doubtless enjoy the experience of travel to Australia, where the airfares and accommodation are picked up by the relevant festival. In addition, at the Sydney Writers' Festival, all writers received a daily fee. I used to argue at board meetings this was not necessary for locally based writers, that almost all of these would happily appear to talk about their books. But as in some other matters, I never had any success in getting a majority of the board to agree with this point of view. On the general question of how festivals should be funded, the Sydney Writers' Festival in my time had a mixture of public funding, corporate sponsorship and private donations. On the public side, the New South Wales Government and the City of Sydney each put in, as I recall, $250,000 a year. It might be a little more now. And one of the conditions of this funding was that at least half the events would be free, as opposed to, for example, Melbourne, where I think all the events are ticketed and carry a charge. Another condition was that some of the events were to be held in parts of Western Sydney, away from the central locations of the Wharves in Hickson Road and the Opera House. Any public funding carries some responsibility, although it must be said that in the case of the Sydney Writers' Festival, the expenditure by the New South Wales Government and the City of Sydney was not large in comparison with public expenditures on many other cultural and sporting exercises. It would hardly compare, for example, to government donations to the Australian Opera, to which I'm a subscriber and therefore a beneficiary, or the government expenditures on sporting projects like the current construction of the new grandstand at the SCG, mm-hmm. where I'm a member and also a beneficiary, where I think $62 million might have been put in by the state government. One of the problems, I think, with corporate sponsorship and private donations is the effect that these sources of revenue can have on the composition of the governing body. There's been a noticeable trend in appointments to the boards of cultural bodies in Australia towards corporate managers, particularly from the financial sector, and wealthy individuals. This has been influenced at least in part by the expectation that this kind of board member will provide access to sponsorship and to private funding. And so it probably does. But it's resulted in the boards of cultural bodies being very similar in composition to boards generally in the private and the public sector. It always seemed to me that it would be a good idea to have some writers on the boards of literary festivals, although it may be that many writers don't want to be distracted from their work by meetings and by functions. There were some writers on the board of the Sydney Writers' Festival during my time, and there still are, but writing was usually not their chief professional activity. There's a real question, in my view, about the optimum size for a festival. Sydney Writers' Festival grew sharply over the period that I was on the board, 2001 to 2011. And this gives rise to questions of style as well as finances. I'm not suggesting that festivals should be so small that large potential audiences are, in effect, locked out by the number of events being limited. But the size of individual events to some extent determines the extent of audience participation, and the sheer size of a program can be a factor in diluting the quality of the events. One phenomenon that has not been created by literary festivals but certainly been fostered by them is that of the writer as a celebrity. Someone who's been a lifelong reader and a sometime writer, I don't find this a particularly attractive development, but obviously festivals want to get the biggest names to boost audiences, which usually means overseas writers, and there's no turning back the clock on this issue. It has cost implications for festivals when they compete with each other for a particular celebrity author by offering first-class airfares, lavish accommodation, opulent hospitality, etc. Even so, the long flights to Australia from England or the United States have always meant that some writers are not to be tempted, whatever the largesse that's been offered to them. It's true, however, that festivals also provide some exposure for the writers of new fiction and poetry, two areas that have traditionally found it difficult to obtain reviews in the literary pages. There is, of course, a more general problem about book reviews in Australia, which Alice has referred to, where there's simply not enough space for even the smallest fraction of newly published works to be reviewed. If one takes Sydney, for example, there's literary pages of The Australian and the Sydney Morning Herald, which have been shrinking, of course, together with some brief reviews in the Sun Herald. There are, of course, some small literary magazines, but it's the absence of widely read periodicals in Australia that sharply confines the readership of book reviews in comparison with, for example, the US or the UK. The Spectator, the Australian Spectator, usually has one book review a week in its Australian section, but it's largely an English publication, and it's an extraordinary fact, I think, that there is no weekly periodical in Australia at this time. There's certainly one sense in which the quality of public discussion has declined over the last couple of decades in this country and shows no signs of reviving. Now, on the issue of program content, Gerard has pointed out, as Alice noted, there's not a great deal of diversity in the social and political views of the writers and the commentators appearing at recent Sydney Writers' Festivals. This is largely true for the Melbourne Festival. I haven't examined the program for other festivals around the country, but I imagine that a similar criticism could be made in most cases. In explaining this phenomenon, as opposed to defending it, needs to be remembered that institutions are a product of their own societies, and literary festivals in Australia are a product of a part of Australian society, publishers, writers, bureaucrats and the media, that largely shares a common view on most social and political questions. There are quite a number of persons in all of those groups, of course, who hold different views, but they represent a minority opinion. There's not much doubt about the fact of this consensus, but the reasons for it are more difficult to divine. When I was at university in the late 1960s, seemingly a long time ago, but not long by historical standards, most corporate managers, senior bureaucrats, lawyers, together with a good proportion of academics and journalists, were, for example, sympathetic to America's role in the world, sympathetic to the actions of the police and other law enforcement bodies in dealing with crime, sympathetic to policies designed to secure the country's borders, and had some scepticism about government regulation. Those groups now largely hold almost exactly the opposite views. This was a development that was identified by Nick Cater in his book The Lucky Culture, published earlier this year. But I'm not sure that the book provides an explanation of how this exactly happened, and I'm not planning to try and do that this evening. But the turnaround does help to explain the programs at literary festivals, because, as I've already suggested, literary festivals are organised by a relatively small segment of our society. And the views that I've referred to earlier, while they're not widely held in the general community, are largely held by those groups that occupy Australia's cultural worlds, one of which, using the word in the broadest sense, is the media. Having said all that, it's always seemed to me that even these groups would have more fun at festivals and other events if there was sometimes an actual debate on social and political questions, that is, some robust disagreement between the presenters, with the audience able to ultimately join in and express their opinions. This was something else I raised from time to time at board meetings, but it seldom happened when the program came out. This is not, of course, just a problem for literary festivals. If it ever did, Australia certainly doesn't now have a tradition of vigorous public debate that has always existed in many ways in the United States. There are plenty of criticisms that can be made of the American political system, but there's a much wider range of ideas there open for discussion than in the relatively narrow spectrum of Australian politics. And the same can be said about a wide variety of social and economic issues about which it's difficult to spark any debate in Australia. Let me give one example. Over the last year or so, there's been some criticism of legislation at the federal and state level in this country that makes expressions of opinion offensive to individuals unlawful. Criticism is that this is a serious limitation on freedom of speech. I've written two or three newspaper articles putting forward this view. Various other commentators have made the same argument in the media and at conferences. There has, however, never been any response to these arguments. It doesn't follow from that, of course, that they're necessarily right. This is not because there's no one who holds the contrary view. The fact is that this kind of, if this legislation exists at the federal and state level, it's because there were powerful groups who persuaded governments to enact those statutes. But those groups obviously feel no need to defend their position or any desire to engage with their opponents in public debate. It's hard to imagine this kind of silence in the US or even in England from one side in a contest about, ironically, freedom of speech. It might be said, of course, by those organising literary festivals that most of their audiences do not want to be challenged in their views, and Alice has already referred to that point. And there's some truth in it. my observations of audiences over 10 years at the Sydney Writers Festival, analysis observations at one session at least, suggested that most of them shared the social and political views of the presenters and were not particularly interested in hearing a contrary opinion. That is, however, no reason in my view why audiences should not sometimes be confronted with contrary opinions. Quite apart from the value of public debate, it's simply more fun, in my experience, to get an argument going, both on the stage and in the audience. But as I say, this doesn't seem now, if it ever was, to be part of the Australian tradition. Having said all that, there's little doubt that in Australia the Literary Festival is an established and an expanding notion. It seems unlikely to me that this trend will change in the immediate future, notwithstanding the enormous volume of electronic communications that are encountered every day by most people in our society, and which may ultimately affect the way in which many books themselves are read. As I mentioned at the start, there's a social aspect to the Literary Festival above and beyond the once solitary experience of reading. There will, however, hopefully, always be some readers who, like Robert Louis Stevenson, a great storyteller himself, think that one of life's greatest pleasures is, to use Stevenson's words, a long, silent, solitary, lamplit evening by the fire, in his case then with the novels of Alexandre Dumas. Thanks very much.
Thanks to Michael and thanks to Alison. So we come to questions and discussion. As I said at the start, we did ask Chip Rowley and the former Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers Festival and Gemma Birrell, the current Artistic Director, along, but they couldn't make it. So there we go. So we come to the questions and discussion. Might just lead up with Alice if you had any reports back from cultural life in Queensland since Campbell Newman abandoned the Premier's Literary Award, and it seemed that this might have a traumatic effect on Australian society, as it was reported. But what's the word in Queensland about the terror Newman? What's happening up there?
Well, I don't know if you've followed the story that in response to the closure of the Literary Awards, which I think this is a off the top of my head, but as far as I remember, the cost of the awards was about $250,000 a year, so it pales in comparison to some of those pay increases that the MPs were going to be awarded. But the Queensland literary population has decided that it's just untenable to operate without literary awards, and so they have gone ahead and made their own. The prize money is an awful lot smaller than the government version, but it still continues to exist in one way.
Thank you. Okay, so we come to question down the back. I think you two might just stand on either side of the microphone and I'll disappear over here. Yep.
Thank you very much, Gerald. I'm Mauricio Mesa from Colombia, South America.
Could you come?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. I have very close friends that are starting to write, so I have a question for both of you. The first one is, from the publishing perspective, what is important these days for these guys to make it to the big world? What is really important for a new writer to make sure that, I mean, their books make it to the market? And secondly, from the book, shows and that sort of things, what is important, I mean, from the processes perspective, how can they make it to the book, to make their books, promoted.
And okay, we got it. All right, so who wants to respond?
You're the publisher, you go first.
The first thing I would say is to advise your friends to read, because unless they're aware of what's going on in the marketplace, then they're not able to respond. They won't know what the trends are, what the publishers are liking to do. And also, I'm a proponent of the idea that if you want to be read, if you want people to buy your books, you should go ahead and buy other people's books too, because otherwise the system can't hold. But as far as promotion goes, it's It's very tough. I mean, as Michael was saying, the space for reviews is dwindling seriously. I'm involved with the Sydney Review of Books, which is coming out of the University of Western Sydney and publishes just 2 reviews a week, but they're long form, so they take a lot more time to produce and to edit. So again, I would say for people to consume the culture that they would like to create, but also to really inform themselves as much as possible about what already exists.
Sydney Review of Books, is that online?
Online.
Okay. So, do you want to make a comment?
I will say something. I think that it's important to understand that that the publishing world in Australia and cultural world in Australia is a very small one overall. So that it would be my observation, Alice might disagree, but it would be my observation that most books in Australia are published because of some kind of personal contact between the author and a publisher, and that while it's not impossible for a person without that kind of personal entree to have a book published, it is extremely difficult. And as far as marketing is concerned, something of the same could be said, that most of the marketing is, of course, done through the media. And again, the Australian media functions largely on personal contacts between individuals and journalists. So you're talking about a relatively small community. Now, I'm sure that to a large extent this is also true in England and the US and so on, but it's particularly true in Australia, I think, because we are talking about a relatively small group.
Question here.
Alice, you referred to the homogeneity of speakers and audiences and festivals as the greatest strength and the greatest shortcoming of these festivals. From where I'm sitting, it's hard to see these strengths given the poor treatment that can be given to anybody with a more conservative viewpoint, and also the potential for this small-mindedness, as you said, to be reinforced and strengthened without any conflicting viewpoints when people do just bask in their own ideology. I was wondering if you could elaborate on some of the strengths that you alluded to.
Mm. So it's a question about the treatment of people with the conservative viewpoints. If you just talk in the microphone.
I think it's a strength insofar in relation to actually what Michael was saying, in that it means that audiences continue to come and that they're prepared to hand over their money. So as far as the homogeneity is concerned, I mean, I feel as though the artistic directors do often try to have a range of people from different cultural backgrounds. There's a debate about whether or not that's tokenistic. But I think that it's a strength in the sense that it is playing to the kinds of people who are happy to go along and pay money to go. And that so long as it's a strength in the sense that it means that they will continue to have large audiences, that those people will go away feeling, you know, warm and fuzzy and happy about their experience, and that it sort of affirms for them what they already think. So it's only a strength in that sense, not in the sense of a robust intellectual debate.
I just want to add, so just one thing I should have said when I made those remarks on that subject is that, of course, there are a lot of sessions at any literary festival that don't have a social and political content. In other words, if you're doing a session on Jane Austen, well, pretty hard to get contemporary politics into that. But to that extent, one can say that literary festivals serve that kind of literary purpose and literary discussion, but in terms of sessions that do have a social and political content, of which there are a lot at the Sydney Writers Festival, the Melbourne Writers Festival and so on, yes, there's a very homogenous set of views, which is the way that Alice has described it.
In this secular age, to what extent is the literary celebrity cult Writers Festival taken the place of church?
Well, a lot of institutions have taken the place of churches to some extent. For some people in the community, political parties or perhaps political movements, to put it more broadly than political parties, to take the environmental movement, for example, just as one case. There's a lot of those sorts of things have taken the role that the churches used to have 30 and 40 and 50 years ago. And I suppose to some extent, if you're looking at communal activities, literary festivals carry out that sort of role.
Tom?
Oh, sorry. I can respond to that too. I mean, in the sense that some writers will deliver a sermon of sorts at a writer's festival, I feel as though that there is an element of truth to that, that there is this sense of a kind of secular cathedral down at Walsh Bay, and that there are acolytes for these writers. And, I mean, for instance, Jeffrey Genedes was in town a couple of years ago for the Writers' Festival, and it was reported in Crikey, amongst other places, that he behaved rather inappropriately, but that didn't have any sort of impact on the way that people perceived him, because he is an incredibly popular figure, and he could just behave exactly as he wished.
Tom,
yep.
If you look at the spectrum of content, on one end you've got reality, and the other end you've got fantasy, do you see any movements in the last 10 years, and can you foresee what will happen in the next 10 years, perhaps, as an add-on to this gentleman's question also, in terms of assisting future writers?
So what might happen about assisting future writers? I guess they'll apply for grants, will they?
Sure.
Talking about content.
Oh, content.
Do you mean fantasy in the sense that people have fantasies about how their work will get out into the world? Or? Oh, sorry, right. Well, if television is anything to go by, then fantasy is going to be doing very well for the next 10 years. I think that it's difficult to make those sorts of predictions, because all I can think about, I don't have a crystal ball, I can only look at what's working at the moment. But certainly fantasy is a very big deal right now, and young adult fiction is one of the few areas that is a growth area for sales in publishing, and that generally has dystopias and fantastical elements, that sort of thing.
I just want to add a sentence. In almost all areas of society, you'll find now that fantasy is more popular than reality.
Okay, we're going to be quick. Yeah.
All right, well, I was one of the founders of Romance Writers Australia, and I don't write them because I can't read them, but I know a lot about their organisation. Constantly upgraded. Now, this month there's going to be a conference in August, and Harlequin will possibly, one year they sell an editor from London, or Harlequin will send an editor from New York to the conference. This time, Penguin are putting on a cocktail party for the people attending, and it seems to me that publishers are looking for these writers. You know damn well they're there. They'll send Nora Roberts.
Okay. I think the suggestion is...
Does any other publisher bother to meet their writers in this way? Any other publisher?
So it's a nice word for romance publishers.
No, but will the others do it?
Well, will anyone match the romance is the question.
Well, we all need a bit more romance in our lives, I think.
Jay.
Vera.
I was wondering that on one hand, there is this cry from publishers all the time here that there is less and less people reading and less and less demand for books. So on the other hand, it seems to me, and for others, that there are so many books published that there is almost, when you go into a bookshop, it's almost impossible to get your eyes and your time around it. On the other hand, I was wondering if there is a connection between the proliferation of these writers' festivals, for whatever opinions they seem to be demanding or expressing or wanting to hear, most of them are echoes, and on this proliferation of a lot of rubbish.
Are literary festivals responsible for the publication of too many books? I think that's the question.
There's a maximum in publishing that 20% of the books pay for 80% of the business, and publishers don't know what's going to work in advance, so it's just there is a degree of taking what they would argue is a studied risk. I think some people would call just being foolhardy. Yes, I agree that there are too many books being published, and it means that they need to push harder and harder to try and get the attention in shrinking space for the same number of books.
Yeah. You mentioned Malcolm Turnbull was booed recently. Considering 3 years ago, the convicted terrorist David Hicks got a standing ovation. What's that say about the audiences? Are they based on Q&A audiences, or just have to be that way inclined?
Yeah, they read through your Twitter account before you're allowed to buy a ticket, and they find out where your political allegiances lie.
Can I say just in something about that? That I mentioned the fact that the audiences
at the Sydney Writers Festival, I mean, don't seem to be a very diverse group, and the story that Alice tells us is just simply an example of that, and the David Hicks is an example of that as well. I mean, the example of Q&A is, of course, quite a good one, because it's evident that, I mean, that the standing ovation for David Hicks does represent the view of quite a few people, not a large proportion of our community, but certainly a group in our community that has access to the media and has very strong opinions and is well represented at things like literary festivals.
Question of Michael: if the Sydney Writers Festival receives public subsidies or contributions, I presume they publish their accounts from time to time. So can you tell us whether what appears to be a successful festival actually makes a profit, or whether if they see a profit on the horizon, they go out of their way to make sure it disappears?
the festival is a company limited by guarantee, so I assume the accounts are available in... They would be available in any event because of the public funding. I don't know if anyone's ever asked to look at them. Usually, the festival made a profit in my time, sometimes small, and sometimes there was enough to put into the next year. There's obviously no point in continually accumulating profits, because it's a non-profit organisation. But in fact, any money that was left over from 1 year would go into the next. So there isn't an accumulation.
Where was it? You've had a question, so I'm just going to take the others first. Who found this question here?
Yeah, sort of a similar question, but so I was wondering if you could define what the KPIs are for the Sydney Writers Festival.
What are the key performance indicators for the Sydney Writers Festival?
And then if you both could maybe say what you would like them to be to enact whatever change like to see in this.
Well, I'm not going to go through the management plan, which those sorts of documents, which of course people spend huge amounts of time drawing up now. I mean, the size of the audience is one thing, but that's why I raised the question of what is the optimum size for a festival, whether you just want to keep getting bigger and bigger. Another is the kind of large names that can be attracted. I mean, another KPI is on the financial side. You don't want to make a loss. One thing that I would have liked to have seen more of, as I say, is more diversity in debate and in some of the people who were speaking at the festivals. But I mean, on the face of it, I mean, the Sydney Writers Festival has been a very successful event over the last decade or so.
Question here, Alice. You mentioned that a lot of writers are concerned with piracy and also getting recognition. Do you think that there's any? They try to get whether there's any advantage getting around publishing their short story through a third publication like the Reader's Digest or something, which has an established market, and trying to get an initial name recognition through that means before doing it on their own. What are the advantages and disadvantages of using a third publication to get up your story?
Yes, it's a way of getting attention. I know that there was a writer recently who had one piece in the monthly and was approached by a publisher and then had a publishing deal as a result of one article. So these things do happen, and it's a way of raising your profile, and raising your profile as a writer is likely to help.
Yes, last Saturday the Woollahra Council had a writers' festival. It was from 10 to 4, had four major speakers. It was pretty good on the whole. But I noticed the audience was overwhelmingly old women of both sexes. and bleeding hearts. And the mayor and a number of councillors came along at the very end to be seen handing out prizes. At the very end, they weren't there for the... I was just wondering, why do you suppose males don't want to go to these things? And why are they all bleeding hearts?
Seems to be some kind of critique of the Woollahra Writers Festival. I wasn't there, but I didn't get asked.
I tried to deal with the bleeding heart question, which is it's certainly a phenomenon. Just how it's all happened is harder to explain. I'm thinking back to the audience at the Sydney Writers Festival. It's true that there were more women than men. It wasn't hopelessly outnumbered. I haven't heard the phrase since my father, I think, of old women of both sexes. I'd almost forgotten it, really. But there's no doubt that I think there were more women than men at the Sydney Writers Festival. Although there was a spread in the audience, there were some, in terms of age groups and sexes and so on.
Right, now right up the back row. No, because you've had a question. Yeah, two questions. Yeah.
You mentioned the problem of debate and ideas. Do you think other venues have taken over that role? Like you mentioned Q&A, that there's a thing, the Festival of Big Ideas and the Site YouTube and the Ethics Centre.
The St James Ethics Centre. Well, can I deal with some of those? I mean, I wouldn't call Q&A a discussion. And as for, if you're talking about, there's something called the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. So someone actually had published a book called the Festival of Really Dangerous Ideas. Because the Festival of Dangerous Ideas didn't look too dangerous to me. St James Ethics Centre, yeah, well, they're doing, I mean, the Sydney Institute, the Lowy Institute, the St James. So there are bodies that are doing putting on good shows in this area. As I say, I think the point about the Writers' Festivals is that there's not enough balance. But I've tried to explain that the way they're put together and by the people that they're put together, that's pretty much an inevitable consequence.
You
want to
make a comment? There's a question here.
I may be able to make an inspiring or hopeful suggestion about what's going to happen. Because for getting on for 2 years now, I've had a Kindle, and the greatest joy of my life is I can read all these books and I can see what other people said about them. And it's extremely encouraging to know that there's people out there in America who are saying, I mean, this has never happened in my entire life.
Okay, so?
Yeah.
Kindle.
I think this may make things better.
Okay, yeah. Suggestion.
The awareness becomes but
what's the Kindle going to do for writers' festivals? That's the point.
One of the things I touched on is that publishers don't know how to make sufficient profit from e-books on the whole to make it worthwhile producing them. So we have to figure out how that economy of scale is going to work out. And the other problem with Kindles, which is, I mean, I saw David Suzuki sign one once, but it's very difficult. You sort of have a limited amount of space to get signatures on your Kindle.
Right, have I missed anyone? All right, you can have a go, but you've got to be brief, okay?
Thank you very much, Daryl. From the Australian perspective, I mean, do you see a lot of new Australian writers coming through, or I mean, we are in a situation where it's always the same writers. How do you see the situation today?
Well, what's the new talent? What does Caesar tell you about the new talent on the writing perspective?
Well, Western Sydney came up. Caesar's just connected with a Western Sydney writing group, and we've found some very impressive talent out there, and people who don't just sound like all the bleeding heart, latte sipping, you know, inner city Melbourne types. They have something a little bit different to say, which we're enjoying. But one of the things that happens with new writers is booksellers don't have a sales history that says, oh, the last two books didn't do that well. It's quite neat with a new writer. You get to say, hey, this is a brand new one. You haven't tried them. They're going to do wonderfully. And there's no evidence to the contrary, so booksellers are a bit more prepared to take a punt on it. So in a way, debut writers have more of a chance than somebody who's had a couple of books published that didn't do so well.
Michael, any idea about new talent? Where will we find it?
No, I think Alice is the person to talk about that from the publishing industry, really.
So just as a final question, do you think any of this criticism will make any difference, or will the literary festival just go on like they've always got on with everyone agreeing with everyone else? I mean, what's on the horizon of the literary festival?
Well, much more of the same, I think. Exactly. And I've tried to explain why that's going to be so. But as I say, sometimes there's progress on
in small ways in these kinds of areas. And the only way you get any progress is by drawing attention to it and pushing for change. And everyone here has got has made a contribution in that sense tonight.
I agree. I think that I think it's only by people having this discussion that there's a chance of things changing. I think that for the most part things will continue, but agitators such as Michael and myself will hopefully be able to have some sort of influence. Fingers crossed.
Many thanks. I'll be...
I'll be very brief. I mean, there's no doubt at all that the writers' festivals in places like Sydney and Melbourne and elsewhere do attract very large audiences, and they are therefore significant. They have support of major newspapers in both cities. So what's been offered here tonight is a critique of what is a successful, in terms of audience attendance, function is an interesting critique tonight, and very grateful to Michael Sexton and to Wallace Grundy, both of whom have had involvement with writers' festivals over the years, are coming along tonight and giving us their views. The talk will be up on the podcast. Talks will be up on the podcast tomorrow. The papers will be published by Anne and the Sydney papers online, and Channel 648's here tonight as well. So many thanks for a stimulating evening. Thank you, Michael. And thank you all.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.